This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Respect for Marriage Act passed in the U.S. Senate yesterday with a 61-36 vote. 12 Republicans joined Democrats in supporting the bill. If passed, the act would specify some federal protections for same-sex marriage and interracial marriage. That would be especially significant if the U.S. Supreme Court were to overturn a decision that allows same-sex marriage nationwide. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin is one of the lead sponsors of the legislation. She spoke yesterday after the Senate signed or passed the bill.
I know why people felt that they were at risk. And I am so proud to stand beside a bipartisan group of leaders who made a commitment to advance the Respect for Marriage Act, again, while listening so carefully to our colleagues to make sure that concerns the concerns raised about religious liberties were addressed and that people were heard. So with that, what a great day, which will make a difference in so many millions of people's lives.
That'll now go to the U.S. House, which passed a similar but not identical bill earlier this year. Howard Schwaber is professor of political science at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, nice to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about what this bill does and doesn't do?
Sure. So the bill does not, let's start from the beginning, does not require all states to recognize same-sex marriages. In fact, it almost certainly couldn't do that. That is beyond the powers of Congress under Article 1 of the Constitution. So the very first starting point is, if Obergefell, that's the Supreme Court decision recognizing same-sex marriage and requiring the states to recognize them, if that case were to be overturned, as some people fear might happen, this law does not have the ability to, the power, let's say, Congress doesn't have the power to restore a national rule of that kind. What this bill does do is says that if one state recognizes same-sex marriage, then a couple married in that state who travel to a different state are entitled to have their marriage recognized, even if in the new state that they're now inhabiting or visiting, same-sex marriages are not allowed.
This also means that the federal government would recognize a same-sex marriage if it was done legally in a state in that situation. Is that important?
Yes, that's correct. It's extremely important. So this law overrules the Defense of Marriage Act, which was a law that said that the federal government, for purposes of benefits in particular, other things as well, but benefits and legal prerogatives, will not recognize the same-sex marriage. Overturning that law now means, and under the terms of the new law, it is now the case that the federal government will recognize as valid for tax purposes, for benefits purposes, for access to legal records purposes, any marriage that is valid in the state in which it is performed, including same-sex marriages.
Does this really change much of anything right now, as long as that Supreme Court decision you mentioned, Obergefell, remains in effect?
Probably not. There are the one part that has an immediate effect is the overturning of the Defense of Marriage Act, and that's only because that law covers so many things. I've seen an estimate there are 30,000 separate federal benefits or entitlements that come with the federal government recognizing a marriage. So Obergefell certainly meant that the Defense of Marriage Act couldn't be applied broadly in the way it was originally understood, but there were all kinds of detailed questions that hadn't been worked out that are now kind of swept away. So the biggest immediate impact will be on practices by federal agencies and federal entities. In terms of life on the ground, so to speak, not that that doesn't involve people's lives, but in terms of what goes on in the states and who can get married, that is now remains governed by Obergefell. It remains the case that there's a nationally recognized constitutional right for same-sex couples to marry and an obligation for all states to recognize those marriages. So this law is really a safeguard against the possibility of Obergefell being overturned, which is something that Justice Thomas alluded to, for example, in his opinion in the Dobbs case recently.
Right. I wanted to get to that. We had Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin, as we heard, a lead sponsor. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson voted against it. One of the reasons he cited was, hey, this Obergefell decision is in place. It's settled law. There's no move to overturn it. People in response said, well, that's what people said about Roe v. Wade a couple years ago. Do you think it would be likely that legal challenges would percolate up from states to the U.S. Supreme Court to potentially overturn Obergefell?
Oh, I think that there is no question that that will happen. This gets to be a long conversation about the Dobbs opinion, the one that overturned Roe versus Wade and what it said and how it's written. But the short version is that opinion is written in a way that absolutely invites challenges to recently recognized rights under the Due Process Clause, including the right of same-sex marriage. I don't mean it only leaves open that possibility. I mean that the majority opinion and the other opinions in the case really are written in a way that that issues an invitation to lawyers around the country, come file a suit, come challenge Obergefell, and see what you can get.
Justice Alito, in the majority opinion, says this is just about abortion. This doesn't apply. This isn't precedent for Obergefell. Justice Thomas, in a separate opinion, says, yeah, oh, yeah, it does. Basically, yeah. We can't predict what the U.S. Supreme Court would do. What do you think the arguments would be if it came to that, if a state case came to the U.S. Supreme Court on Obergefell?
Well, Alito, in fact, talks out of both sides of his mouth. He says this is only about abortion, but then the terms in which he describes the right to abortion that is being overturned are carefully framed in order to include things like Obergefell. So rights recognized subsequent to the 1970s, for example, are treated with a special suspicion. The arguments would be that that Dobbs, the Supreme Court case, means that we will not recognize rights as under what's called substantive due process, which is just a name for a way of recognizing rights under the Constitution. Courts will not recognize that type of right, rights that are not listed in the Bill of Rights, that's the key, unless they meet certain conditions and unless the description of that right is one that is part of our longstanding tradition. Well, you can certainly make an argument that recognizing same-sex marriage is not a longstanding tradition in American life, in American history. And really, that's all you have to say to raise at least an argument under Dobbs that Obergefell should be revisited. There are other things in the Dobbs opinion that give other clues or cues even to people wanting to challenge Obergefell how to go about it in a way that Alito at least is likely to find sympathetic. So I think the suggestion that Dobbs can be cabined in a way that it only applies to the right to abortion is really wrongheaded. And it's not just about this case. It's always the case that when a general principle is announced in the context of a specific dispute, the general principle later is applied to other disputes. The other case from the last summer, of course, is the Bruin gun case. That has the same quality. It's about the Second Amendment right to guns, but it's written in a way that invites a whole range of challenges to a whole range of regulations. And we've already begun to see that play out as lower courts are striking down laws that don't fit that case's particular tests. So I think both of those two cases, you know, they got a lot of attention because they were about abortion and guns, which are politically highly salient topics and very much in the news. But their much, much deeper importance is that they announced kind of a pathway or an approach to challenging rights claims and regulatory assertions by government in ways we have not seen before. And that process has not even begun to play itself out.
Talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison's Political Science Department, looking at the Respect for Marriage Act passed the U.S. Senate, protections for same-sex marriage. Howard, some changes made in this to get some Republican support. Republican critics worried, they raised concerns about religious liberties if this law would require religious institutions and others to recognize same-sex marriage. Can you talk about that religious liberty angle?
Sure. It's a big topic. The history goes back to what's called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. So what happened was in 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court issued an opinion that said government is not required to make accommodations to religious believers so they don't have to follow laws that contradict their religious beliefs. That was controversial, and Congress responded with something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA. That said, no, we are going to insist that the right to free exercise of religion be understood in a way that protects believers against the operation of laws that apply generally. That law was then ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, which said, no, only the court gets to determine what rights are. Congress doesn't get to say what freedom of religion involves. It was all very complicated. Today, there are now RFRA statutes in multiple states. I don't think all states, but the majority of them, as well as one that applies to operations of the federal government. So on the one hand, if you think, for example, about the famous Hobby Lobby case, that was about the federal statute, not the First Amendment. So on the one hand, there is both strong political support and statutory protection for the idea that religious believers should not be required to comply with laws, or at least not unless there's a really, really good reason for it, like preventing child abuse, for example, you know, something on that level. And unless there's a concern on that level, religious believers should not be required to follow laws if doing so would violate their religious principles. On the other hand, as a constitutional principle, that has not been accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's a kind of middle ground. There are Republicans you're talking about were concerned that if this law didn't include exemptions for religious organizations and religious providers of goods and services, it could be construed by courts to require those organizations and those persons to participate in things like providing decorations or food or photography for a same-sex wedding. And they were very, very eager to shield religious, particularly Christian conservative religious believers from that possibility. So it was a trade-off. I think the liberals and the Democrats and the progressives certainly would have preferred a law that simply required everyone to treat same-sex couples the same way they treat other couples and require a general equality in the marketplace and in treatment by government. There isn't enough bipartisan political support for that kind of general equality guarantee. And this, I think the Democrats accept that as the next best thing.
Looking to the future, if Obergefell, the law, in effect, legalizing same-sex marriage in states that hadn't already legalized themselves, if that were to get overturned, what happens? Do states like Wisconsin go back to the day before that Supreme Court ruling?
Well, it's the same thing as we have seen happen with abortion. So if in Wisconsin, for example, there was a very old 1841 anti-abortion law on the books. After Roe versus Wade, that law was deemed unconstitutional, but it remained there. So that when Dobbs came down and Roe was overturned, that law suddenly went back into effect again. So yes, presumptively, if Obergefell were overturned, everything goes back to status quo ante of the day before it was decided, which in the case of Wisconsin would mean that the state constitutional amendment defining marriage as only between a man and a woman goes back into effect. At that point, we have a very interesting question. So I mentioned that the federal law, the new law, requires states to recognize marriages from out of states, including same-sex marriages or interracial marriages or any other marriage. That's actually in conflict with a long-standing constitutional tradition, which says that where it's a matter of important public policy, states are not required to recognize marriages from other states. In other words, there's something called a full faith and credit clause in the Constitution, but that has for a long time consistently been understood not to require one state to recognize another state's marriages. Consider the fact that different states have different age limits, for example. In some states, a person can get married as young as 14. If that person then moves to a state where the age of marriage is 17, I'm making up these numbers, would that second state have to accept that this 14 or 15-year-old is married according to their laws? And the answer has always been no. This federal law proposes to use Congress's Commerce Clause authority to force states to recognize one another's acts of marriage, of licensing marriages. And I have to say, it's not 100% clear that the Roberts Supreme Court would accept even this law as constitutional.
Howard, we'll leave it there. A lot to think about. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the U.S. Senate passing the Respect for Marriage Act yesterday, showing support for same-sex and interracial marriage.